This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 3, String Contention, Objections, and Disputes, held on the 1st of August, 2017. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room only. Other than Jim Prendergast, is anyone else on the audio bridge? If so, please let yourself be known now. Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it over to Jeff Newman. Please begin.
Thanks. Welcome, everyone. And everyone bear with me. We have on our agenda, I know we're just kind of, the agenda's out there up on the top right side. We'll do our normal statements of interest, give a little bit of update as to where we are on the plenary, and then go dive straight into CC2, continuing where we left off from the last time. And I see the note from Jamie to go back to 3.1.5. So I think that's where we will start with CC2, and then we will get into any other business, if there is any. So let me ask now, are there any updates to anybody else have anything to add to the agenda first? Okay, not seeing any. Any updates to any statements of interest that anyone wants to report? Okay, not seeing anyone on Adobe or hearing anyone. I'll start with, I guess, an update on the plenary, and Avery's on if she wants to add. We have a call going, the full group call will, the next one will be on Monday, next Monday. So that would be August, I'm getting my dates mixed up. We'll see, today is the 1st. So it will be the 7th, I believe, will be Monday the 7th. So that will be our next full group call. And then just to note for the record, because neither Avery or I will be around 2 weeks from that point, we are changing the date of the second call for August, the full group call, to, I believe, it is the 28th. Which would be Monday, the last Monday. So we're going to actually have 3 weeks in between the next full group call. As far as what we're working on the last call, we talked a little bit about the rounds versus first come, first serve on the full group. And then we will start off next time talking a little bit more about that, as well as predictability and some other mechanisms where we can ensure that the next process is a more predictable one, yet has whatever needed flexibility is needed to ensure that changes can be made if they absolutely need to be made. The other thing full group-wise is that we are working and should either today or shortly, today or tomorrow, we will get out invites to the each of the SOs and ACs on inviting them to appoint a leader for new WorkFact 5. And once those leaders are in place, we'll discuss the terms of reference and then move on to issue a full group or a full call for participants for that WorkFact. That's the plenary update. Anything that any questions, or Avery, if there's anything you want to add? Okay, not seeing anything. So Avery's typing. I'll give her no addition. Okay, great. So let's go on to CC2 responses, and we're going to, per Jamie's request, we're going to go back to 3.1.5. Which talks about naming the objection procedures in the 2012 round. So the question to the community was, are you aware of any instances? and if they could provide examples of any evidence. And the first, if you have your phone, I would ask everyone to put their phones on mute unless you're speaking. So we are on page 7, and the doctor.
Jeff, this is Paul McGrady. My phone is not on mute, and it made a weird noise. I'm not on the bridge. I just wanted to announce that I finally made it to the call, but I'm not on the Adobe Connect, I mean.
Oh, great. Okay, thanks, Paul. And if you want to speak, just interrupt, let us know, and we'll put you in the queue. Okay, back to 3.1.5. And Jamie, if you're on, which I see you are, if you want to go through these comments, since you filed the first one, I can read it, or we can just have you kind of talk to it. Let's see.
Yeah, sure. This is Jamie. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, I hear you great. Thanks, Jamie.
Great. I think one of the things that I wanted to point out and illustrate through the example provided is that for some reason in the community objections, there was the process of determining whether somebody was able to file an objection, whether they had standing, was not done until the objection was actually already moved to the panelist. And it is a very concerning glitch in this process because it allows for anyone, even if they don't have standing, to start a proceeding and force a community application to actually respond to an objection before it's even determined if they have standing to file an objection. I don't know that that was necessarily the intent, but in the way it was implemented, we certainly found ourselves caught in a gaming situation where someone filed an objection without the support of an organization, and it was only revealed way down the road. And it was, unfortunately, there's not a process in the community objection for those concerns to be highlighted and dealt with. And I think that standing is something that should be determined before a community is ever pulled into an objection, and I've included some suggestions on how that could possibly be dealt with as well. I won't regurgitate the entire scenario because it's well documented, but in the information we provided, but I'm certainly able to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thanks, Jamie. And to ask a question, are you aware then of any cases that a response was forced to be filed where standing ultimately was not met? Or are there examples that you cite in I know these comments are just kind of summarized here, but are there examples where had there been a process in place, someone would not have had to respond?
Well, the community objections are all confidential, and so I don't have any insights as to anybody else that may have suffered the same scenario that we suffered. So unfortunately, I can't help you there. But it certainly was very clear in our case that had standing been checked before the community application was drawn into the objection, that it could have prevented a whole lot of time, money, and energy from being wasted.
Jeff, this is Paul.
So, yeah, please, absolutely. Paul, yeah.
Thanks. I guess another follow-up question to that would be, would there be any harm in requiring a standing check before a response, rather than asking, you know, do we have examples of it, especially if the proceedings were confidential? Maybe the better question is there any harm in requiring it up front? Because if there isn't, and there's a possibility of gaming if we don't, then why not? But if there is a harm, then we should think through that now. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Jamie, and I certainly can't think of any harm as it relates to our experience. In fact, we tried to elevate the information to both the ICANN staff, to the ICANN ombudsman, and even the I don't think it was called the BGC back then, but the NGPC or whatever it was called. And we were, in fact, denied by all of them for them to actually look into it. I think part of the reason was because there wasn't a process in place that allowed them to take that action. And so the fallback was just to almost force us to go through the community objection. Had we not been able to get the organization that was falsely being represented and drag them into the process and have them actually write to ICANN to denounce what had happened and to take their name off of it. You know, we were very lucky that we had links to the group, even though it still took us quite a long time to get them to do it because they had no idea what was going on and who ICANN was and what this was all about. I don't know that other community applications in other circumstances would have been able to do what we were able to do to prevent this from going to a community objection.
Thanks, Jamie. I guess the question I have, and Paul's is a good one too, and I think it seems, I'm not hearing any objection, but or seeing any on the list, so it seems like perhaps requiring a standing quick look or some sort of evaluation of standing prior to a response seems like a good addition. I think we might just have to think of some of the implications, and I noticed that you in your comments did put in about costs and what your proposal is. So I think that's a really good comment. I know also the registries have weighed in as well and affiliates on making sure that the basic requirements for standing are met. But let's hear from, because we have a queue now, so Jamie and then Alan.
Thanks, Jeff. This is Jamie Baxter. And secondly, the objection I was just referring to is one that never actually made it to the panelist, despite, you know, that being the goal. The other issue is the objection that did make it to the list also didn't pass standing. And so, you know, the drawback to the community applicant is that they have to still pay a 5,000 euro fee to just respond to the community objection. And on top of that, there's the time element that impedes the application from moving forward as well. And in that case, if they don't get standing, there's no way that the community application can be successful. And so I agree that standing should be established before a community applicant ever has to respond or be drawn in or pay any fees, also hopefully speeding up any process that otherwise causes delay.
Thanks, Jamie. Alan.
Thank you very much, Alan Greenberg speaking. I'm certainly not an expert on this, but I'm just wondering as I'm listening to the discussion whether there may be cases where the decision that the person, that the group does not have standing is at least partially based on the contents of the response. And if that is potentially a factor, then you would want the determination ahead of time to be a preliminary one or something like that, so that it, even if the person was granted standing at that point, it could still be reversed based on the contents of the objection. That may be completely irrelevant, but I think it's something we need to think about. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. And as Jamie gets into the queue, that was going to be one of my questions as well, is should there be an opportunity to respond even on that limited point of whether the complainant meets standing or not. Jamie, please.
Yes, this is Jamie. Alan, thank you. That's actually a very good point. And I think it's important to make it clear that standing has no connection to the complaint itself, that there is a standard that is applied to determine standing, that is separate. And so you're absolutely correct in asking that question, and I think it's very clear that the answer to that is no. Standing can absolutely be determined without ever understanding what the complaint is, because it's a very specific standard used.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie. Alan.
Thank you. Again, I disavow any real knowledge of it, but I still worry that the review, no matter how specific it is, might miss something that the applicant itself, that the response itself catches, that the panelists or whoever makes the determination might not have caught. So I have no stake in this, but I want to make sure that we're not losing a potential for catching something like that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Alan. And Anne, I was going to read your comments in, but if you want to cover them as well, I noticed you're next in the queue. So, Anne.
Thank you. This is Anne for the transcript. Thanks, Jeff. I agree with both Jamie and with Alan. I think that it makes a lot of sense to have a screening based on standing, but I do agree with Alan that if you don't have the opportunity for both sides to plead on the issue of standing, you don't have the full picture. And I think actually, reflecting on it, it might in fact, support the basic notion of getting rid of gaming if there is an opportunity for both sides to plead, because as Alan has pointed out, you can have an initial determination that there is standing, but the applicant may have facts available to the applicant that certainly a panelist is not required to go out and independently verify, but the applicant needs a chance to contest the whatever's being pled in the standing, so that if that initial determination is going to be true and on the merits, both sides should plead. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Anne. And you've had some agreement from Alan, and then Jamie, please.
Yes, thanks. Jamie again, two quick things. I think if we all go back and look at the standing requirements, they really do relate to the existence, the time of existence of the organization, how big the organization is. It's very factual items. And so I'm still not seeing the connection that you're concerned about. I understand that it may be valid, but I think going back and looking at the criteria to determine standing is going to be very important here, because it did seem like it had a very specific shape to it. The other thing I want to point out is that we had been told by ICANN that if the standing isn't achieved, then the impact of the complaint itself has absolutely no bearing on anything at any point down the road. So I want to also make that point, that going through the objection just to see if there are concerns that are valid despite the organization having standing or the objector having standing, ICANN has told us in multiple communications that whatever is said and determined in that from that complaint has absolutely no bearing on anything else down the road. And the example that I'll give you is that our panelist we did have to respond to said that he was not going to hold up he was not going to hold up .LGBT from proceeding because the gay community was going to get .gay. And when we tried to use that going forward in following procedures, we were told that anything that comes from that community objection, if it is unsuccessful, is not even usable in any other proceedings. So I think it's important. I may not have articulated that very well, but it's important to also understand that if they don't have standing, there's really no valid reason for even going through the complaint.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie. Any other questions or comments on 3.1.5? Okay, great. And then as we kind of I'm scrolling through here, I think we covered most of the points from the comments that were received. There is a comment from the RYSG I want to point out that says that no individual entity should be able to participate in both objection and CPE for the same strain. So the registries and affiliates felt that if someone were filing for CPE, they should not also have the ability to object. And so I was wondering if anyone wanted to discuss that, because that would be a fundamental change to the process, but I think merits some discussion. I think it's an interesting recommendation. Any thoughts on that? Ann, please.
Yes, Jeff, it's Ann. I remember reading that with some degree of concern because, first of all, I think that we didn't necessarily have enough, you know, community objections that prevailed in the last round, and that's a matter of concern. And I'm not sure that an applicant for a community application should somehow be forced to give up the right to object simply because they've also made an application. And the objection standards are hopefully, you know, objective enough and clearly defined enough that if you have the basis for an objection, it's relevant whether or not you've applied for a community application. Now, maybe I'm not understanding the comment, but I don't see that to be, you know, It's very obvious. It's a disclosed, I guess you would say, potential conflict of interest. But for the same reason that you've applied for community evaluation, you might be able to establish a good objection to someone else's application. And given, you know, that it's very obvious and there's a lot of disclosure, I'm not sure why that would be the case. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ann. And as we get ready for Jamie, if there's anyone that was involved in the crafting of the registry comment or affiliates' comment that wants to also get in the queue, could also explain why that's in there, that would be great. But let me go to Jamie.
Thank you. This is Jamie. I also have a little bit of concern with that suggestion, perhaps because it just raises more questions for me. One being, if a community application decides to choose CPE, if they're given those two choices, does that nobody can file objections against the community application? It just raises several questions for me.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. I think the implication is that it's one or the other. So if someone applied for CPE, they would forego their right to object to another application. I'm looking to see if there's anyone on here from the registries that may have been involved in drafting that, but I'm not seeing anyone. So that's – why don't we – put that comment on the list or the question on the list, maybe for some clarification from the registries as an action item.
Yeah, hey, Jeff,
okay. Yes, please. Thanks, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, yeah, instead, I think this does need a little more explanation because I think there's, listening to it, there's a little confusion behind it. So maybe some proactive outreach to either one of the drafters from the stakeholder group and or affiliates to join the next call so they can talk it through as opposed to type it through. That might be helpful as well.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Let's document that as an action item, if we could, ICANN staff, and either I or one of the co-chairs of the of this group will reach out to the registry stakeholder group and ask them if they can provide a little bit more explanation about this particular point. Okay, I'm just looking at some of the comments. It seems like it's going back. We're capturing all the comments from the chat, so that's great. Let's move on to 3.1.6, and this goes to the role of the independent objector. And so there were some definite, I think, divergence in a opinions on this one. And certainly within our group, there was certainly earlier discussions of the utility of the independent objector. And so this question then is asking, you know, do you believe we should still have it going forward? Or if not, then why? Or if yes, are there any restrictions or modifications that should be put on for future application windows? Nominate and ALAC expressed that they do believe that there is a role for the IO going forward, and that there could be quality control process similar to what's used in Nominate's dispute resolution service. And ALAC has said that there were allegations of lack of objectivity, and so steps should be taken to make sure that the IO is says beyond reproach. I think it probably means that that there should be some accountability. The BC has stated that the IO is not warranted in the future application process, and it was not designed, according to the BC, to or in the GNSO policymaking process. The IO was paid from the applicant fees, but it did not prove beneficial to applicants. The IO was not independent, was politically or personally motivated, and did not accomplish their stated work. The IO filed 19 objections, won 2 decisions at $1 million per objection. With a success rate of 2%, you know, that's not a high one. And then 2 cases, a hospital and a charity, were also changed later. The, and I'll get to Alan in a second. The registries, the RDS raised some concerns and suggested changes. So the registries, DRG and Affilius, said that it has an important theoretical function, especially for entities or third parties that don't have the financial capability to object. But in the 2012 round, their view, the independent objector deviated from the function, appeared to have an activist agenda, and rather than hearing, filtering, and advancing concerns of third parties. Further, the independent objector's behavior in 2012 raised questions of conflict of interest, and we believe the following recommendations could help address issues faced. Number one, require established support for objections by the independent objector, establish clear conflict of interest procedures, and require the independent objector to withdraw duplicate objection. Of course, there's full comments on the record that everyone should go back and review. I have Alan, I have Ann in the queue, and I may put myself in as an individual as well. Thanks. Alan, please.
Thank you. Alan Greenberg speaking. I find the statistics quoted by the BC interesting, and I think they have to be considered as we go forward, and the registry suggestions I think may well have merit. I do want to comment on one of the statements in the BC comment, though, that the IO was paid from applicant fees but did not prove beneficial to applicants. I think the fact that this is an objection process is implicitly going to prove not beneficial to at least some applicants if the objection is filed, or whether it wins or not, because there's costs associated with it. But ICANN does have a public interest component in its mandate. And, yes, these things have to be funded from somewhere, and we've said the program should be self-funding. So there's no choice but to fund it from the fees. So that particular statement, I think, is a complete red herring. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Alan. Next, we have Ann.
Yes, thank you, Jeff. It's Ann for the transcript. I wanted to return to the topic of standing, but this time in relation to the question of independent objector, because it sounds as though there was a lot of dissatisfaction with actions taken by the independent objector, but I am curious as to who would have standing to file a limited public interest objection if that is not a task that's assigned to the independent objector. And I don't know whether there would be, you know, additional policymaking required to determine who would have that kind of standing to, you know, whether or not there's a valid claim under a limited public interest objection. And I know that one of the bases for a limited public interest objection is that a string violates human rights. And we have a, you know, more recent update to core values placing an emphasis on human rights. So as just a hypothetical, if there's no independent objector, who files the objection to the dot sex slave string?
Yeah, thanks. And sorry, were you finished, or did I didn't mean to interrupt. Did I interrupt? Sorry.
Yeah, I kind of surprised myself by actually saying that. Let me just say theoretically, who files the objection, the limited public interest objection? Is there an alternative that we think works better than the independent objector? Who has standing? Sorry. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. You're right that the independent objector was created to get past the requirements of standing, to make sure that there was someone that could always object based on those morality, public order, limited public interest. And so that's why that role was created. And so your question is a very good one in that if we get rid of the independent objector, who then could have standing in such a case? So I think that's something that that needs to be thought about. I'm going to take off my chair hat for a moment, and just as an individual comment based on. Yes, please. Okay, so Paul, after my comment, I'll put you in. So my comment as chair, again, is solely as just an experience. From my perception, I think that the independent objector, in a lot of respects, went beyond the morality, public order, limited public interest that was envisioned, like, as Ann pointed out, the dot, Ann's example, dot sex slave, or dot Nazi, or dot vulgarity, or whatever it is. That's what it was intended for, but the independent objector started to object, did object to things like dot health, which weren't really offending standards of morality or public order. It wasn't envisioned for that. And as one of the working at the time for one of the respondents to an independent objector objection, it cost us a lot of money to prepare a response, ultimately prevail, but still the amount of money that we were out of pocket in filing fees and legal fees and others was extraordinary. For in our belief, the independent objector being allowed to go well beyond its stated mandate. So for, as an individual, my comment would be that if we do have the IO going forward, that there would either need to be a better quick look process to make sure that the IO is staying within its mandate before a response needs to be filed, or some other check. Make sure that the scope is quite limited. And in the example of dot health, which is the one that I was responding to, I remember that there were other objections filed by other people, so standing wasn't necessarily an issue. So with that, I will take my individual hat off, put my chair hat back on, and go over to Paul.
Thanks, Jeff. I have two basic questions, and I'm sorry, it may be in the materials, but do we know how many objections the IO was successful in, and also how many total dollars the ICANN community of applicants paid him?
Thanks, Paul. I don't have that independently. I don't know if staff has that. I know the BC had filed a comment saying that there were 19 objections and only two successful, and many of the objections were hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we could probably come up with that figure.
Yeah, I'd like to see if we can, because if he had two successful objections and we paid him, I thought somebody said it was millions of dollars. Then I do, and I hate to sound like I'm, you know, from Chicago, but I am. At some point, we do have to do an efficiency analysis on that to find out whether or not that's a good use of money. If we paid him $200,000 and we got two successful objections, then I guess hooray. But if we paid him $2 million or $4 million or whatever it is we paid him, and we got two successful objections, then I have to say really not hooray. And we have to decide, I guess, as a community, whether or not that's good money after bad. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Ann, next in the queue. Ann, please. Yes,
yes,
sorry,
thank
Jim,
you.
Is that you?
Yeah, well, just throw me in the queue.
Okay, we'll do Ann and then Jim. Ann, please, sorry to interrupt.
Yes, thanks. It's Ann again, and just kind of in response to Paul's comment and a couple of other folks, I think the question whether the independent objector made good decisions and or wasted ICANN money is a different question from whether there should be somebody with standing to file a limited public interest objection. It might be more helpful for a group to focus on how would the independent objector or some other body be required to document support for, you know, the valid nature of a limited public interest objection, you know, what that would require within the community to validate the notion that, yes, this qualifies as a limited public interest objection. It sounds as though the problem that we're facing is one individual making a determination that should be made on a broader basis with broader support, and that if that's done properly, that the issue of wasting money would take care of itself. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. I see your point that they are, in fact, two different questions, and the role should be separated on the performance. So I think that's a good comment. I just want to also read the comment from Alan, who says, I presume the IO is not paid on a per-objection basis. That would be a direct conflict of interest. I think that's right, Alan, but I'm not 100% sure. They may have been paid on an hourly fee, but I'm not positive of that. We'll have to go back and do some research and take that on as an action item, unless anyone knows. I see Trang's typing, so maybe Trang knows that information. In the meantime, Greg's got his hand raised, so let me go over to Greg, please.
Thanks. It's Greg Chapman for the record. And I think there is, you know, there are a number of kind of separate but related questions all around the IO. And I think it would be instructive to look at the 17 failed objections and see why the IO did not prevail, and look at that in conjunction with your remarks as an individual, Jeff. The IO went far beyond its remit, and if there's kind of a a coherent relationship between the ones where the IO went beyond the remit and the ones where the IO lost. That may also indicate that there was kind of a massive frolic and detour problem here with the IO, especially the IO being kind of unchecked and going beyond its remit and then losing repeatedly. Or could it be that the IO was not competent in its ability to defend its objections, which is kind of a different problem? But to understand kind of what went wrong and what went right here, and how to do it, if at all, for the future. I mean, it's nice to give a voice to the voiceless, maybe even in critical, but in a sense you're not giving a voice to anybody but the independent objector, and you know, checks and balances on what the independent objector does and clarity on its remit would seem to be really important if we're going to continue this tradition. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. And I just also want to remind everyone that, and someone please correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the independent objector was only supposed to file an objection if comments were raised by the public in the initial public comment period. I think that was one of the requirements. So it was designed to look at the public comments that were received and then to represent if it rose to the level or whatever threshold it was, that it was supposed to give voice, as you said, to those that filed a public comment. So I think your comment about looking more closely at the failed objections is a good one, and also ensuring, as Ann said, that that someone would always have standing to look out for the public interest when to not leave them voiceless. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Sorry, Jim, you're in the queue. Jim.
Yeah, so, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I don't think the IO was compensated on a per-case basis, but I do remember there being a fixed budget allocated for the function that included a salary. And I remember when I saw that, I said, well, there's no way we're going to get through this period without him doing something, because he couldn't justify taking $250,000 or $500,000, and not actually file objections. So I think that feeds a little bit into the, did they go outside the scope because they felt pressure to defend their existence? I think that sort of compensation structure, I think, needs to be looked at prior to the next round so that we don't artificially incentivize them to do something when, in fact, doing nothing could actually be the right course of action.
Yes, this is Paul. Can I get in the queue as well?
Yes, please, Paul.
So this goes to Ann's comment with regards to who will do this if the independent objector doesn't do it. And I do think we need to be unafraid to look at whether or not this independent objector idea really served its essential purpose. I don't know how much thought was put into it leading up to the last round, but I do think that it's sort of an odd construct to think that there's one person out there in the world that is able to hold in their head at all times all the public interests of all the people of the planet. That seems to me to be an odd concentration and a leap of faith. That if we look at this and decide that the independent objector process from the last round was a bit of a waste of money and certainly a waste of not only ICANN's money but also the 17 applicants that prevailed, then we do need to look at, you know, is there a different mechanism or is there a different group already participating within ICANN that has a similar remit, and do they already have mechanisms to object based upon public interest grounds? You know, those are all interesting questions, but I don't think that we have to stick with this notion that there is one person out there on the planet that is uniquely qualified to, uphold the public interest of everybody else on the planet. And frankly, because what's public interest in one place oftentimes conflicts with what's public interest in another. And so I do think we need to be fearless when we look at this I think we need to look at the money spent and, frankly, the poor track record of outcomes here. But we also need to really question the underlying philosophical basis for this job. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. I'm just looking, trying to do some quick research as you're speaking as to what the budget was. So I will continue to do that. And Avery, you're next, please. Avery, are you, if you're speaking, I can't hear you.
Can I be heard now?
Thank you. Yes.
I can be heard now. Okay, thanks. I have a lot of lag in my Adobe Connect response. I think that there's another thing. You need to go back and check. I believe that people were able to come to the independent objector with issues for him or her to consider. So I don't think it's a exaggerated notion of one person being the representative of the world and such, but rather a place where those concerns can funnel in. So I do think, and speaking personally, I think that if we are going to have these kinds of public interest concerns, there does need to be a way to funnel it into the process. Into the system. And the last thing that I've been saying in the list is that if we're going to start looking at function and expenditure and value for money, this is not going to be the only one we need to subject to that kind of analysis. And I'm not sure whether it's in our scope to do that, but if we start to do that, we really have to look at a whole lot of functions and the amount spent on them and the value of that money. Now, that comes out of the fees, but we all care about the fees. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Avery. Okay, thanks. Is there anyone that wants to add any additional comments? Oh, I thought I heard Paul or Jim, but nope.
No, Jeff, other than this is Paul, other than to say that Aubrey's comments are well taken.
You guys? Okay, so yeah, so please, if, and Avery, I'll hope you remind us of your comments too, and we're talking about other aspects of the program that you think, and everybody believe we need to look at in terms of budget and the amount of the expenditures. I just want to go back a little bit in the comments. I have lag time in my comments as well for my Adobe, so I apologize for that. Amy says that it's going to be hard to do a full 360 review on the IO. We will never have any idea of how many GTLD ideas or applications were thwarted by just the existence of it. And Anne says, underlying philosophical basis was a limited public interest objection. If poorly executed, needs to be fixed. Otherwise, we are getting rid of that objection. And Trang then adds, the applicant guidebook also says, in light of the public interest goal noted above, the IO shall not object to an application unless at least one comment in opposition to the application is made in the public sphere. And Avery then says, can we invite the IO for a discussion? Avery, that's a good request. Let's take that for our leadership meeting and see. We may have to go through ICANN staff to make that formal request, but I think that would be a good recommendation. Also want to draw everyone's attention to the fact that the IO did spend some time as well discussing the issue of, and even objecting in certain cases to the closed generic issue. So I think that was also on the IO page. So that might be something, once we have a decision one way or the other on that issue, that hopefully will, that issue would be taken off the table for an IO. I know we have 5 minutes left. I don't want to waste that time. So we can go to 3.1.7, which I think is a interesting one, which is dealing with the one versus three panels, panels. And should the cost of objections reflect that choice? The registries, DRG, and affiliates recommended that parties should be able to jointly determine whether to use a one- or three-person panel. And I believe that was the main comment that we got. We all recognize that one panel experts, or so one expert panels have a lower cost, but the three panelists seems to come up with more consistent results. And so in balance of those trade-offs, the recommendation from the RYSG affiliates and BRG was that the parties should be able to jointly determine whether one or three panels should be used. So, and then says if there's a failure to agree, then the default should be the three person. Any quick discussion on that issue? And when I say quick, I don't mean that we don't have time to fully discuss it. We can certainly discuss it on the list or in the next call. I did want to just see if there were any comments on that issue going forward. Thoughts? Okay, still some more comments on the aisle. So we will pick up with that issue as well on the list. And a suggestion Ann has that says, what if the ICANN board appointed a non-conflicted subcommittee to look at that. So that's a recommendation. And Susan then says the final activity report may be of interest and posts the link of that. Other questions or comments either on the IO or the one versus three panelists? Okay, I am not seeing any comments, so this probably seems like a good place to stop for today, but let's keep the activity on the list. We will probably come back to the IO, hopefully maybe even with some input from the IO on the next call, but realize we have a lot of ground to cover and not a huge amount of discussion on the list. I'd appreciate it. Is there anyone else that has anything that they want to add in the last couple minutes on any other business? Okay, Terry has posted. Next call will be on Tuesday, August 15th at 2000 UTC for an hour. I will unfortunately not be on that call. I will be on vacation, but I am sure I will listen to the recording with great interest. Okay, with that, seeing no comments or anyone in the queue, and talk to everyone on the full group call on Monday. And actually, there is a Work Track 4 call on Thursday. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.